Are we born knowing right from wrong, or is it something we have to learn? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll talk with a guest this hour whose studies of babies and young children have led him to conclude that we have an innate moral sense. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions on this. Do you agree that we have an inborn moral sense? A sense of right and wrong? Why or why not? Where do you think morality comes from? And do you see moral behavior in young children? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Paul Bloom, a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University and author of Just Babies, The Origin of Good and Evil. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So what was the purpose of this book?
I've always been interested in morality, and I've always been interested where morality comes from. So the purpose of the book is to talk about what we start with, and I think impress people, as I've been impressed, with the powers of the baby's moral sense, what baby's sense of right and wrong, their empathy, their fairness, their sense of justice, but at the same time focus on the limits, how so much of what we view as valuable as adults, as critically important as moral beings, doesn't show up in babies. So I want to talk about babies have and what babies don't have.
All right. Well, how did you find out what babies have and what they don't have? How do you study children that young?
Well, it's a good question, because if I want to know about your morality, I can see what you do. I can ask you questions, and you can't do that with a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is develop experiments to take advantage of the few things babies can do. So, for instance, some studies involve babies' reactions to the pain of others, to another crying baby. And you see that babies, when exposed to a crying baby, will cry themselves. When they see a baby in pain, they'll suffer themselves, and they'll try to soothe the other baby by patting or stroking it. In our own research at Yale, and this is work I've done with my wife, Karen Wynn, we show babies one-act plays. We show them little plays, little puppet shows, where, say, one character is trying to get up a hill. Another character helps it up the hill, and a third character pushes it down the hill. And then we hold up the good guy and the bad guy in front of the baby, and we see which one they prefer. And we've done this in a variety of different shows. And what we find is before a baby's first birthday, they could tell the good guy from the bad guy, and they prefer the good guy.
That is really something. So what about the child, though, that takes his truck and conks the other child on the head with it?
Well, babies are like people. Babies are complex beings. So on the one hand, there's probably some differences between people, some genetic differences in how empathetic and how compassionate we are. And also, for all of us, there's often a sense between what we know is right and what we do at the time. There's all sorts of things where I know what the right thing is to do. My sense of morality is intact in that way. But I might choose to do the other thing out of self-interest. I don't think I conk people on the head, but I might yell at them and feel bad about it later because we have both impulses in our heads at the same time, good and evil.
So morality is something that we're born with.
Morality is in large part something that we're born with, yes.
Yeah, and but it can, what are the limitations to that morality?
So there's a lot of limitations. So there's a lot that you and I would agree are right and wrong that babies have no inkling on. Like, we know slavery is wrong. But that's an accomplishment, a cultural accomplishment, accomplishment of reason, similar to the accomplishments of science. We're not born with that. More generally, our morality extends to strangers. We might care about people in faraway lands, like the people who are suffering from the typhoon in the Philippines. Our morality will extend to people from other groups from us in our own country, towards people whose skin are a different color or speak with a different accent. There's no evidence that babies and young children have moralities that extend more broadly. They start off as, you know, I call them natural-born bigots. They start off with a very narrow, very parochial morality. And what we do in a good society is we expand that morality. But it's not there to start with.
Hmm. Yeah, do we know how the brain creates a moral sense?
The exact neurophysiology of how this all works is largely mysterious. We know that there's different parts of the brain that are involved. So chunks of the brain, say, near the amygdala, which is a chunk of the brain, are involved in moral emotions like shame and guilt and anger and sometimes moral disgust, while other parts of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, the part right behind your forehead, are involved in reasoning about in self-control, in deliberation, and thinking things through, in saying, yeah, I know this feels right, but if I think about it a bit, I know I should be doing the other thing. And actually, that part of the brain, the part of the brain involved in self-control, is the very slowest to mature. Even in teenagers, it's not fully developed, which is why, to some extent, the moral lives of teenagers are a little bit different from the moral lives of the rest of us.
So then if babies are born with this morality, and it sounds like you're seeing the good aspect mm-hmm. of the morality, are babies born evil?
I think babies are born, on the one hand, with all of the sort of selfish impulses that we have as adults, and I'm not sure I'd go as far as to call it evil, but, you know, if you, for instance, babies, before their first birthday, know full well that the right way to distribute something is to distribute it fairly and evenly. If there's two kids and there's a windfall, two objects, two toys, or two cookies, they know the right thing to do is give one cookie to one kid and one cookie to the other. They could show they prefer people to do that. But if they themselves get the good, the two cookies, they'll keep them both. Children and toddlers are far more selfish than adults.
Yes.
And so I think that there's a sense in which, I'm not sure I'd want to call it evil, but it's certainly a case where your selfishness and your own desires override what you think is right.
Well, I guess I'm trying to think if the morality is hardwired, how do we explain psychopaths?
Well, psychopaths are a very interesting case. So there's a lot of cases where we do terrible things. People do terrible things. And we're not psychopaths. We do terrible things because we feel we need to, or we've talked ourselves into it, or we're drunk, or we're angry. We have a lot of desires. And again, knowing what's right won't always stop us. But then there really are the case of psychopaths. And psychopaths are people who, I think for reasons that are partially genetic and partially environmental, just don't care about other people. They don't empathize. They don't have compassion. There are stories of psychopaths who murder people, and then when they're interviewed later as to why they did it, they said they were curious of what it would be like. And so these are people who really lack a moral sense. In the extreme, all they have is the sort of bad impulses you and I have, but there's nothing to hold them in check. And so they're actually quite scary people.
Yeah. Well, so some people are born with a lack of moral sense then, or did this lack of moral sense develop with the upbringing?
So I would think both. So for every human trait you could imagine, from how tall you are to how aggressive you are, we sort of have this U-shaped curves in our variation. Some people are born, some people turn out to be very tall, some very short, most of us are in the middle, and so on for everything. And this is true also for traits that are relevant for morality. So some people start off with an extreme sensitivity to suffering of others, deeply compassionate, and others just don't give a damn. They just are pretty cold-blooded. When you look at adults, at least, there's a sex difference. So men tend to be less empathetic than women. Men are far more prone to violence than women. So some of this is genetic, I think. But then there's environmental cues. Your environment can tell you what sort of violence is acceptable. So think about the fact that since 1980, the murder rate in the United States has dropped by about half, a staggering change. But our genes didn't change any. So you have to look there and say, wow, the environment is having a huge effect on who kills who. And the environment also has an effect on moral attitudes. Right now, there are very few people who would be against interracial marriage. But when you asked the question in the mid-90s, about half of Americans were against interracial marriage. And these show me that morality is more than what's in the genes, but it can be powerfully affected by the world in which we live.
Can someone who has a poor sense of morality when born be diverted from the life of evil?
I think so. I just think it's more difficult. So, and I think just just about everybody has some sense of morality. We often differ in how aggressive we are and our temperament and so on. So one bit of good news is that empathy, how empathetic you are, is actually not as related to bad behavior or good behavior as one might think. You could be too empathetic. People, if you see somebody, a child crying in pain, and you start crying in pain because you're empathizing with the kid, that's kind of useless. You're going to want to distance yourself and say, look, the kid's in trouble, I'm going to help him. On the flip side, somebody can be pretty low in empathy, but have a strong sense of fairness and justice. Some individuals with Asperger's syndrome are pretty low empathy. They don't tend to actually put themselves in the shoes of other people, but they use their reason and their intelligence to say, look, this is fair and this isn't fair. And so I don't think, I think to some extent some people are more naturally predisposed, even as babies, to become good people than others. But I'm quite optimistic that even, the worst role of the genetic dice could be compensated by a loving and educational environment.
We are talking with Paul Bloom, a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, and the author of Just Babies, The Origin of Good and Evil. And we welcome your questions for him on what we know when we are born. Do we know the difference between right and wrong? Are we born with a moral sense? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking this hour about the origins of morality and whether babies are born good or evil. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Do you see moral behavior in young children or behavior that concerns you regarding morality in young children? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Paul Bloom, professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, author of Just Babies, The Origin of Good and Evil. I'm curious, Professor Bloom, because we heard that children who hurt animals are probably going to turn into serial killers. And there has been somewhat of a movement to teach compassion to children, compassion to animals. Can you talk about whether there is a connection there?
I think, first, there are very few serial killers in the world. There's a lot of kids who hurt animals. In some cultures, hurting animals is just sort of a very standard thing to do. In a lot of smaller societies, kids torture birds and bugs and so on. So I think worries about your kid turning into a serial killer are just statistically very, very unlikely. Most kids who do these sorts of behaviors grow up to be perfectly normal people. On the other hand, I think hurting animals is wrong. It's certainly wrong for the animal. It's also, it also in some way, I think, could engender and build in the kid a habit of disregard for other beings. So I think most parents have it right in the feeling that you try to sort of nurture compassion and caring in your child, and teaching it to care for an animal, emphasizing the extent to which these creatures suffer and should be treated better, is definitely a good thing. But I think the serial killer worries are a little bit over the top.
So is there any role for culture or religion to teach morality?
Well, the case of religion is actually kind of interesting. In the United States, religious people are actually in some ways much more moral than atheists. They give a lot more to charity, for instance. They're also much happier. And people have pointed this out as an evidence for the power of religion. But it gets complicated because you look across countries, and the countries that are the most religious, like the United States, are the worst in all sorts of objective measures, in murder, rape, drug addiction, teen pregnancy, and so on. While atheist countries like Sweden or Finland are actually much better places to live when it comes to, say, interpersonal violence. I think part of the answer then is religion will be useful and will be positive to the extent it conveys messages that are positive. If it conveys that you should hate certain groups or value your own group over others, it's probably going to have a morally negative effect. If it preaches values of charity and kindness and generosity, it will have a positive effect. So the fact that we have this innate core leaves it fully open that it could be nurtured and expanded and developed by societies. And we see this all the time. So I do think that parents do have a tremendous and important role in developing their children's moral lives.
Yeah. How does logic and reason play into morality?
Well, I'm a big fan of logic and reason because I think that if you're a good person and you want to make the world a better place, you're not going to get that far by listening to your gut. For instance, your gut will tell you that if there's a little girl trapped in a well and she will die unless she's saved, this is the most important thing in the world. When it comes to issues like climate change and other broad-scale issues, your gut doesn't tell you anything. Your gut tells you the life of one is worth more than the life of a million because we could respond empathetically to the one but not to the million. So I think what logic does is it says, you know, look, my children, people who look like me, are tremendously valuable to me, much more than strangers. But I recognize that this is true for strangers as well. Their children matter to them as much as mine matter to me. And then you could start to build, just on the basis of reason, a sort of impartial morality where everybody matters and everybody should be taken into account. And this shows up in philosophy, but also shows up in religion. All of the versions of the golden rule that every religion has is in some sense the triumph of reason, saying, look, if you want to be a good person, you have to get away from your own sort of special place and special perspective and think broader. And I think it's because of reason that we now know that sexism is wrong, that slavery is wrong, that we have an obligation to the suffering people around the world. So I'm a huge fan.
So why, Professor Bloom, is it important for us to know that the roots of good and evil are a part of human nature, that it is innate?
Well, suppose you want to make the world a better place, either at a public policy level or even as a parent. You want to make the world a better place. Well, it becomes extremely important to know, how do we start? How do children start? So, for instance, there's a lot of evidence I talk about in my book that children are very ready to break the world into us versus them on a basis of skin color, language, where you live, and so on. And what this means is that if you don't want your kid to become racist or bigoted, to grow into racist or bigoted adult, it's not enough just to stand back and let things happen. If you stand back and let things happen, they will definitely form biases, maybe biases you don't want them to form. So it then becomes useful to intervene. And we know, for instance, that if children are brought up in a mixed-race community, particularly a mixed-race school where people get along together, they don't develop racist attitudes. Well, if they're brought up in a school where everyone's the same color, or where there are black kids and white kids and Hispanic kids, but everybody's fighting, they very quickly develop racist attitudes. So knowing this, if you have an interest in your moral development of your kid in certain ways, you'll know what to do.
And I'm sorry, you said that we were born with an us versus them nature?
That's right. From the very start, kids divvy up the world into their own group and other groups. Initially, it starts off as my group is my family, people I know, and the other group is strangers. But later it gets broader. So, for instance, there's a nice study with children before the age of one where they have two people come up to the child, and they each offer the child a toy to play with. And in one condition, one of the people, it's done in America, speaks English to the kid. The other person speaks French. Even the youngest kids you test will take the toy from the person who speaks English. If one person speaks English and the other person speaks English with even a faint accent, these kids will prefer the one who speaks English without an accent. It's as if they say, I know that this person with the strange accent is not a member of my community. They're talking funny. And so very early on, you get these tendencies.
That's fascinating. But you say if that child, though, goes into a a diverse neighborhood or school that that us versus them or the bigotry goes away?
I think it'll go away in certain ways and not others. For one thing, some us versus them is acceptable. If I tell you, you know, I'm paying for my kids' schooling, you're not going to come and say, why aren't you paying for my kids' schooling? Well, because I have an obligation to my kid that I don't have towards your kid.
Mm-hmm.
I have an obligation to my family. You know, and around New Haven there are signs saying, you know, buy local. And that's a call for an us versus them. Put your money here and not elsewhere.
Yeah.
So some of this is acceptable. And some of it never goes away. On the other hand, it would be very awkward to go by a store in New Haven and I had to sign up there, buy white. That seems odd. It seems wrong. Because racial biases are bias we don't want to have. And so you're not going to shut down a person's us-them way of thinking. That's just part of our natures. We wouldn't be human without it, without some such biases. But you can shut it down in some domains and not others. My kids grew up in a school where, which is pretty mixed race, and they have, you know, friends of different races and ethnicities. And they're very innocent of the biases that I had at their age. Because I grew up in a very different environment where the ethnicities and races were quite clashing. They still think in terms of us-them, but the us-them is not a racial sort of thing.
Yeah, well, Gary on Facebook says the us versus them mentality defines our actions much more than we may realize. Although we quickly identify ourselves as members of one group, we have a much harder time identifying those singular groups as members of a larger group, especially since we know that all of those other groups are out to get us.
I think it's true. Part of an us versus them way of thinking is you think of your own group as complicated, full of many individuals, while a them is just amorphous. And so, and particularly when you think about conditions where the us-them distinction is sort of magnified like a times of war. So after 9/11, I bet many Americans thought the Arab world was just one big them. And the distinction between Iran and Iraq and so on was just irrelevant. It's just a world of them, people who hate us. And so you lose, you not only divide the world into different groups, But your thinking of the other group loses all nuance and sophistication. You don't like them. You don't want to think about them. And it's difficult to appreciate that they're every bit as complicated as you are.
We are talking with Paul Bloom. He is the author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil, talking about whether we are naturally good or naturally evil. And actually, we're both. Let's welcome your questions. Do you have any questions? Do you agree that we have an inborn sense of right and wrong? Do you see moral behavior in young children? Where do you think morality comes from? And do you think we need to do more to teach morality? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Why is morality important, and how do you think it should be nurtured? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Professor Bloom, Jamie on Facebook wants to define terms like morality, good, bad, and so on. He says that they're subjective, and using them is like building a house without a foundation. So what exactly do we mean by morality?
Well, it's tough, because if you ask people, people mean different things by morality, if you just ask them. So many people say, a secular liberal might say, morality has to do with rights and freedoms and harm. And if it doesn't involve harm and rights and freedoms, it's not even moral at all. But then again, many people around the world define morality as having to do with those things, but also in terms of what you eat, what you wear, and mostly who you have sex with. So certainly, you know, every society has strict rules about who you have sex with, and sometimes these are related to harm. So you have a prohibition against having sex with somebody against their will, because that's a form of violent harm. But many societies have a prohibition against men having sex with men and women having sex with women. Having sex with somebody who's too young or too old is often viewed as morally wrong. So the way, as a scientist interested in morality, I try to sort of study it in a way that doesn't bring my own value judgments into it from the start. And I'll define it like this. The domain of morality, what we should study and think about as moral, involve those actions and beliefs that trigger certain emotions. Emotions like guilt and shame and empathy and compassion and righteous anger and moral disgust. When you see those sorts of emotions, when you hear somebody say, I'm really angry at what that person did, or I feel so sorry for her, I feel ashamed or proud, then you know you're dealing with the world of morality.
Yep. Help us understand why there's different, different morals in different countries or different cultures. There is a culture, at least, that we read about that says it's okay to stone a daughter to death if she's been raped. To use an extreme example, whereas another culture would be horrified by that.
That's right. So there's these profound differences in cultures and what people view as right and wrong. But I'll say two things. One thing is there's deeper similarities. There's no society in the world where it's okay to break a promise. There's no society in the world where it's okay to walk up to somebody and hit them in the face for no reason. So we have a lot of similarities. And even in the cases in which we differ, I think that there are sort of core beliefs that we share. So for instance, if you take you take the sex examples, or examples of how men in some cultures respond to women who have been raped, how people respond to homosexuals, and you think, boy, that's really alien to us. So a lot of, for instance, secular liberals say, I can't understand why people get so upset over the sex lives of other people, other adults who are consenting. They say, that's just totally crazy. The psychologist Jonathan Haidt points out that actually there are some cases where even secular liberals get upset. So think about a brother and a sister, and they're both adults, and they decide to have sex together. And they have a great time. They have wonderful sex together. They have contraception, so having a baby isn't a problem. Then you ask these people, these secular liberals, and often the secular liberals will say, you know, I think they did something wrong. I feel a sort of moral tickle inside me that says something's gone wrong. Now, you know, you might vary in this, but the fact that we could respond the same way to these outrages suggests that people who respond negatively, say, to homosexuals or to interracial marriage, aren't so different from us. They're different enough so that it really matters, but they're the same kind of people, the same kind of responses.
Here's an email from Nikita. I think children are taught good and evil by their parents. On the other hand, children may do evil things, not taught. I think that we want to be good human beings, but it's just not possible because no matter how many good deeds we do, people will still do or think bad things. They have anger and jealousy and greed and selfishness, etc. The key to learning to love and forgive and ask for forgiveness. The key is learning to love and forgive. So are we taught good and evil by our parents?
So there's a couple of things there. My answer would be not entirely. People are surprised to hear this, but you actually look at a baby before any teaching has happened of any serious sort, and there's a moral being there. Babies aren't taught to be upset when someone else suffers. Babies aren't taught that it's better to help somebody than to hurt somebody. Babies aren't taught that it's right to punish somebody who's bad, but not somebody who's good. We see all of those understandings before a baby's first birthday, in situations where there's no way the baby could have been taught. Now, parents teach their kids a lot and a lot about morality, but not everything. And then the general point, which is, you know, an interesting idea about whether or not we could be truly good people. I don't think that the fact that we have bad impulses and bad desires makes us irredeemably bad. I think people are complicated. Some philosophers, such as Aristotle, for instance, said, you know, the existence of these desires, these bad desires, in the long run, is what makes us good. You can't imagine a creature who's good who would never be tempted by being bad.
Let's take a call from Austin in Milwaukee now. Hi, Austin.
Good morning. Appreciate the topic and the conversation. My question to the professor would be, I took a lot of psychology courses in college, and every psychological theory talks about the baby as being born without any kind of sense of morality or sense of social self, and that they're totally self-involved until they learn. And aren't you, by saying that the baby is born with a sense of morality, aren't you devaluating all of these psychological theories?
Yes, I am. I'm afraid you should get your money back. I mean, a lot of what psychologists believed 10, 20, 30 years ago about babies is just totally wrong. It used to be thought, along with a lot of philosophers, babies start the world as blank slates, not knowing anything. You know, and this never seemed right to many parents, but it seemed, you know, it was the doctrine. They don't know anything. And now we know they know a lot. They know a lot about the physical world, they know a lot about the social world, and they know about a lot about morality. But you're right that these findings that have come out, some very recently, really do overthrow a psychological consensus. They overthrow ideas by philosophers like Mill and psychologists like Sigmund Freud, all who thought babies start off with nothing.
Yeah, from Freud to Skinner. I mean, that's what I was always told, that we give human beings credit for almost everything they learn because they're not born with a instinctual predisposition to do stuff, so we give them credit for everything they learn. And you're saying that it's born within them already.
Yeah, and you're right pointing out that the views of Freud and Skinner, in this way at least, have been totally overthrown. And not by people just sort of arguing with them, but by data. There's now so many studies of babies, looking at what babies can do and what babies know. And it didn't have to work out that way, but just one of the big surprises is they start off knowing a lot. And I don't know whether this makes the idea more or less sort of comfortable for you, but the same is true for non-human animals. So a puppy, when it's born, has some understanding of the world, as does a chimpanzee.
We have to take a quick break, and then we will take more calls for our guest, Paul Bloom, who is the author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Paul Bloom is also a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University, and we are welcoming your questions about whether we are born with a sense of right and wrong. Are we born good or evil? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Paul Bloom, author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. And our next caller is David in Milwaukee. Hello, David.
Good morning, Professor. Wonderful discussion. I attended schools in Chicago where there was busing of all different races to make sure the schools were diverse under federal law. And we had a third black, a third Mexican or other assorted Latin race ethnicities, and a third European, whether it's Polish, Irish, Italian, etc. And there were gangs that developed, and all of them along racial lines. There was violence. There were metal detectors. There were shootings. My wide receiver was killed my senior year, who was a good friend of mine and happened to be black. We saw all kinds of horrible violence. And when I had my children, I took great pains to make sure that they were never going to be in a situation where they feared for their lives at school. Yep. And I made sure they were in a school district that didn't have kids from those desperate backgrounds. And I'm listening to what you said about diversity, and I hope I didn't make a mistake. I certainly have drawn upon my experiences. I happen to be a lawyer, and many days I feel like my background gives me a certain leg up when it comes to conflict resolution. But what did I make a mistake?
I don't I'd be in the wrong position to say anybody's made a mistake. It certainly doesn't sound as if you made a mistake. Basically, if you could find a situation for your kids which is safe and comfortable and thriving and diverse in the sense that it gets them to be in touch with different groups and get along with different people, that's terrific. But in many parts of the country, in many parts of the world, that's just not possible, and you have to give up on something. I mean, to throw your children into, if you have a choice, to throw your children into a situation which is violent and with sort of warring groups around ethnic lines is not a good thing to do to children, and also will not make them into sort of people who embrace diversity and don't have us versus them bias. And I'd probably do quite the opposite. If these groups are together but they're in violent conflict, children will tend to identify themselves by what group they belong to. Are they the white kid or the black kid or the Hispanic kid? And then the us-them bias would be exaggerated. So in a perfect world, you'd find a place where these groups get together and the groups, you know, the ethnicities and races just aren't an issue. But if you don't have that, you're not doing any favors to your kid to put them into a dangerous environment with ethnic and racial clashes.
Right.
So no, you weren't doing anything wrong.
Thank you, David, for the call. Mary emails, a related email here. Is there anything parents can do to prevent racial biases in their children if they attend a non-diverse school?
Well, so I have a colleague, Mazreen Banaji, who studies this sort of thing. And she says that one thing you might do is you might expose your child in different ways. And you don't want to be too heavy-handed at this. You want to be honest and frank about it. Expose your child to sort of non-stereotypical representations of the group. If all your kid sees of African-Americans is thugs, or people going to prison, they're going to have a very bad sense of them. And the us versus them distinction is going to go crazy. On the other hand, if they're exposed to people, well, you know, like our president, extremely successful people of different races and different groups, people who are admirable, people who you could respect, it'll make a difference. It'll make a positive difference. The same also holds true for gender, for sex. I think it's worthwhile for those of us who have boys to make sure that they see the fact that women can behave in ways that go beyond the stereotype. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that for both boys and girls, having female science teachers has a big effect on what they think about the role of women in science. So you don't have to live in a whole world that's diverse in a certain ways. You can often create your own world by just exposing yourself to information that you think is true and worth knowing.
We'll take another call from Paul in Bancroft. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I would say just because babies show some unselfishness or moral sense doesn't necessarily mean that it's natural, because the nurturing and environmental factors begin in the womb.
It's true. It's true that when we talk about something being innate and unlearned, we don't mean that the environment doesn't play a role. So definitely, if a child didn't receive proper nutrients in the womb, our proper sort of cuddling or holding early on in life, these moral capacities might not blossom. Just like the visual system needs some support in order so you'll be able to see. I don't doubt that for a minute. But when we say something is innate, what we mean is it's not learned. We mean that you didn't pick it up from your parents, nobody told you about it, it's going to show up universally for all members of the species. And that's the claim I'm making. So I don't deny that nutrients and some sort of early environmental support is needed for the brain to grow. It'd be kind of crazy to deny that. But on the other hand, some things we learn. We learn that slavery is wrong. Other things we don't learn, they just kind of emerge through brain development, like that if somebody's in a lot of pain, that's a bad thing. And I think the scope of things that we don't learn is surprisingly large.
Could the baby even be learning love in the womb? You know, not just nutrients, but even, you know, like you, and not just cuddling as a born baby, but even in the womb, there's already, you know, depending on the condition of the mother, you know, the baby, I think, could already be learning some of these things, not necessarily, you know, the way we learn in school or talking, but just from the feeling. You know, I'm not sure, even, you know, chemically we might be, babies could, inside the womb could be learning certain things. I'm not sure.
Well, I think you have a good insight here that there may well be effects of what's happening in the womb. You wouldn't normally call it learning. So, for instance, when soon after babies are born, they could see the world. They have visual perception. And they have skin. And they have all sorts of other things. And these are dependent on their early environments. But you don't normally say somebody learns to see the world or learns to have skin or hair or bones. So I think your insight is right that the early environment plays a huge role. But I don't think we would normally see it as learning. So you know, think about somebody who knows how to play baseball. That's learned because they received information that's relevant from the environment. The capacities we see in young babies, the moral capacities, don't seem to be learned in the same way.
Thank you, Paul. Nathaniel in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi there. Wonderful show today, I wanted to tell you. I just had a couple questions for you here. First off is that I believe that I had done some research that stated that the Third Reich had actually done some testing on infants that found that infants did have a sense of morality. And the second is, I think that I just wanted your opinion on this, but I believe that people are born inherently good. It's the fact that humanity has a primal desire for power, intelligence, and answering curiosity that kind of steers us away from it. But isn't it the fact that even today we look at society as what defines what's good and wrong? However, society is made up of the individual, and that idea had to come from individuals to define an overall census.
Well, there's a lot of interesting ideas in there. I think that we start off with both. We start off with both good impulses and selfish, perhaps evil, impulses. I see myself as a moral realist, and what I mean by that is I think some things are just, given that we're humans, some things are just good and bad. A society that causes needless suffering is worse than a society without needless suffering. A society with slavery is worse than one without slavery. And I think it's part of our human nature, in at least some cases, to be able to understand these things. Either we understand them from the very start, or we could understand them when our innate systems are linked up with logic and rationality. So I'm sort of, in some way, I don't think morality is as much of a human creation as some people have it. I think to some extent it's the product of evolution, and to some extent it's the product of our reason and deliberation. In that way, morality is actually a little bit like science, where we start off with our basic impressions of the world, but can use experiments and thinking and theorizing to build up from them.
Okay, Nathaniel?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I just wanted to answer if you knew anything about the Third Reich's testing.
I've never heard of such a thing. Sorry.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Well, if morality is inborn or innate, are there evolutionary changes in humans that could change or reduce or enhance our moral sense?
Well, evolution and morality are intimately connected. The reason why we have the moralities that we have is because we're the products of natural selection. And so it's not surprising that we feel affection and care for our kin, our genetic relatives, and for those around us. Evolution continues to happen. I mean, whenever there's more reproductive success for one thing versus another, that will shape the evolution of our species. But the thing to realize is that moral changes in our times are far faster than evolutionary changes. And that shows that they're cultural and not biological. So a couple ones I mentioned before, the staggering drop in crime in America over the last 30 years, the enormous changes in our attitudes about interracial marriage, our attitudes towards gay marriage. Evolutionary changes will happen in the scale of tens to thousands of years. But we've been seeing moral changes happen in the span of years and decades. And so I think evolution will continue to apply, but the process is just far too slow for it to matter for what we care about. And it's going to be cultural changes that are going to drive, that's going to transform the world in different moral ways.
Let's take Joni and Winona next. Hi, Joni.
Hi. I'm calling to ask if your guest could comment on Kohlberg's stages of moral development. This was back in 100 years ago, like 1970s,
yes.
With Piaget and his stages of intellectual development. What about Colbert?
Yeah, so this is related to one of the other callers talking about sort of what they talked about in psychology classes years ago. Most developmental psychologists don't believe Kohlberg stages are accurate in its particulars. But I think Kohlberg had a deep insight, and a lot of psychologists would agree with me. His deep insight is that our morality starts off as a largely emotional, visceral, gut sort of thing. And as we get older, we're able to think more and more about our morality. We're able to talk about it and reason about it and judge it and so on. And Kohlberg said that sort of as you get more and more developmentally sophisticated about morality, I think we become somewhat moral philosophers. And I think it's right. I mean, think about how you talk to your friends and people around you about moral issues, about, you know, about Obamacare, about how we should raise our children, about, you know, who should go to prison for what. We love talking about morality and thinking about morality, and I think that that's a developmental accomplishment that is really important, and that was pointed out very nicely by Kohlberg.
So what research do we still need when it comes to this issue? What do we still need to know about babies' morality and the brain?
We need to know a lot more. We need to have a lot more studies on babies' understanding of different aspects of morality, their understanding of fairness, their understanding of betrayal, of obligation, of promises. And there's a lot you can study with one-year-olds, and there's just we're just kind of getting started on it. I think we also want to study moral change in adults. So, like I said, in the last 20 years, people like you and me, our moralities have changed radically regarding race, regarding sex, and we don't exactly know how. You know, psychologists like me tell stories about this happened and that happened, but it's largely a mystery, and so there's so much more to study.
We have just a minute to go. I mean, did TV played a big role in our changing morality, didn't it?
So I think TV is a wonderful example of how culture can change morality. The biggest changes, put aside violence and homicide, the biggest changes in moral attitudes in my lifetime have been first the how people think about African Americans, how white Americans think about African Americans. So remember, you know, if you go back to when I was a young child, the vast majority of Americans thought that interracial marriage was morally bad. And then the other change was attitudes towards gay people. And in both cases, I think the big catalyst for change wasn't sort of theological arguments or philosophy. It was television. It was shows like The Cosby Show or Will and Grace, which showed Americans, people of these other groups, as, you know, affable, sympathetic, intelligent people. And although we consciously knew that these were actors, they're playing out a role, we you know, our minds at some level can't tell the difference. And so all of a sudden, all these white Americans and straight Americans had black friends and gay friends just over TV. And I think that had a transformative effect.
Well, we could talk more about that, but we're out of time for now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Paul Bloom is author of Just Babies, The Origins of Good and Evil. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Marika Saval for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.